program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Audio Journal's Children's Hour. The selections for this hour are designed for school-age listeners. We will read books, poems, and other children's print material. This program is supported in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. My name is A. Michelle, and I am very excited to be with you today. Our two stories today feature protagonists called Nate. The first one is Nate the Great, in a story called Nate the Great and the Missing Key. To begin, I, Nate the Great, am a detective. I am not afraid of anything, except for one thing. Today I am going to a birthday party for the one thing I am afraid of, Annie's dog, Fang. This morning my dog Sludge and I were getting ready for the party. The doorbell rang. I opened the door. Annie and Fang were standing there. Fang looked bigger than ever, and so did his teeth. But he looked like a birthday dog. He was wearing a stupid sweater and a new collar.
"I need help," Annie said. "I can't find the key to my house, so I can't get inside to have the birthday party for Fang."
I, Nate the Great, was sorry about the key and glad about the party. I said, "Tell me about your key."
"Well," Annie said, "the last time I saw it was when I went out to get Fang a birthday surprise to eat."
"To eat?" I said.
"Yes," Annie said. "Some surprise food. It's the one present I had forgotten to buy. I got Fang lots of presents, a striped sweater, and a new collar with a license number and a name tag, a little silver dog dish, and a little silver bone to hang from the collar. See how pretty Fang looks, and hear how nicely he jingles."
I, Nate the Great, did not want to look at Fang or listen to him. "Tell me more," I said.
"Well, Rosamond and her four cats were at my house," Annie said. "She was helping me get ready for the party. When I went to the store, I left Rosamond and the cats in my house. I left Fang in the yard. I left the key to my house on a table. That is the last time I saw the key. But when I got back, Fang was still in the yard, but the house was locked, and Rosamond and her cats were gone. Rosamond left this note stuck to my front door.
Your key can be found at a place that is round, a place that is safe, and where things are shiny, a place that is big because it's not tiny, and this is a poem, and I went home."
"That is a strange poem," I said.
"Sometimes Rosamond is strange," Annie said.
I, Nate the Great, already knew that. "You must go to Rosamond's house and ask her where she put your key," I said.
"I went to her house," Annie said, "but it was locked, too. I rang the bell, but no one was home."
"This is a big day for Rosamond and locked doors," I said. "Who else has a key to your house?"
"My mother and father, but they went out for the day. They don't like dog parties," Annie said.
I, Nate the Great, knew that dog parties are very easy not to like. But I said, "I will take your case." I wrote a note to my mother. "Dear mother, I am on a case. I am looking for a round, safe, shiny, big place. I do not know where or what a round, safe, shiny, big place is, but when I find it, I will be back. Love, Nate the Great." Annie, Fang, Sludge, and I went to Annie's house. "What does your key look like?" I asked.
"It is silver and shiny," Annie said.
Sludge and I looked around. There were many places to leave a key. Under Annie's doormat, in her flower garden, up her drainpipe, in her mailbox. But they were not round, safe, shiny, and big. I will have to look in other places, I said.
Fag and I will wait for you here, Annie said.
I, Nate the Great, was glad to hear that. Sludge and I went to Oliver's house. Oliver is a pest, but I had a case to solve, and I had a job to do. I knew that Oliver collects shiny things like tin cans, safety pins, badges, poison ivy, and pictures of the sun. Each week he collects one new shiny thing. Perhaps this week it was a key. Did Rosamond leave a shiny key with you in a big round safe place? I asked.
No, Oliver said. This is not my key week. This is my week for shiny eels. Would you like to see my new eel?
I, Nate the Great, did not want to see a new eel or an old eel. I started to leave.
May I follow you?
Oliver asked. No, I said.
I will help you look for the key, Oliver said.
All right, I said. When I go east, you go west. When I go south, you go north.
But we won't be together, Oliver said.
Exactly, I said. Sludge and I left Oliver's house. I did not look back. I knew what I would see. Oliver. I, Nate the Great, was busy thinking and looking. All at once, I saw a big safe place. A bank. I knew there were many round, shiny things in a bank, like pennies and nickels and dimes and quarters. Sludge and I walked inside. Oliver followed us. Sludge and I looked on desks and behind counters. Then we crawled on the floor. If Rosamond had been here, there would be cat hairs all over the floor. I saw paper clips and a broken pen and a penny and mud and a bank guard. First his feet, then the rest of him.
Do you want to make a deposit?
He asked. I, Nate the Great, wished I could deposit Oliver in the bank. I said, did anyone strange with four cats leave a key here? The guard pointed to the door. Sludge and I left. Now, I, Nate the Great, knew where I should not look for the key. A bank was not a strange enough place for a strange person like Rosamond to leave a key. I had to think of a strange place. I thought of a kitchen, with bottles of syrup, hunks of butter, and stacks of pancakes. It was not a strange place, but it was a good place to think of because I, Nate the Great, was hungry. It was time for lunch. Sludge and I started home. I felt something breathing on the back of my neck. I turned around. It was Oliver.
I will follow you forever, Oliver said.
I, Nate the Great, knew that forever was far too long to be followed by Oliver. Sludge and I started to run. We ran down the street, up a hill, around five corners, and into an alley. We lost Oliver. I sat down to rest beside a garbage can. Sludge sniffed it. Sludge likes garbage cans. I stared at the can. I had an idea. A garbage can would be a perfect place for Rosamond to hide a key. It was big and round and shiny with a shiny cover and shiny handles. It was safe because no one would look inside a garbage can except Sludge. And it was a very strange place for a key. Strange enough for Rosamond. There were not many places like that. Now, I, Nate the Great, knew that I had to look in Annie's garbage can. Sludge and I walked to the garbage can behind Annie's house. We bent low. I did not want Annie to see me until I found the key in her garbage can. Then I would surprise her. I tried to pull up the cover. Sludge tried to push up the cover with his nose. I pulled harder. Sludge pushed harder. The cover came off. We looked inside the can. It was empty. I, Nate the Great, had not solved the case. Sludge and I slunk home. I was very hungry. I gave Sludge a bone. I made many pancakes. I sat down to eat them. But I did not have a fork. I opened a drawer. It was full of spoons and knives and forks all together in a shiny silver pile. I had to pick up many spoons and knives before I found a fork. It is hard to find something silver and shiny when it is mixed in with other things that are silver and shiny. I, Nate the Great, thought about that. Maybe Annie's key was someplace where nobody would see it because it was with other shiny silver things. A strange place, a round place, a big place, a safe place. And now I, Nate the Great, knew the place. Sludge and I went back to Annie's house. Annie was sitting in front with Fang. She looked sad. Fang looked big. I ran up to Annie. I know where your key is, I said. Where? Annie asked. Look at Fang's collar, I said. Annie looked.
I see Fang's name tag hanging from his collar, she said, and his license, and his silver dog dish, and his silver bone, and my key.
Yes, I said. I, Nate the Great, say that Rosamond hung your key from Fang's collar. We did not notice it because there were other silver things there.
But why did Rosamond hang it there? Annie asked.
Well, it is a very strange place, I said. And remember Rosamond's poem, a round place, a big and safe place, where things are shiny. Well, Fang's collar is round, and the things hanging from it are shiny. Fang is big and safe. There is no place more safe to leave a key than a few inches from Fang's teeth. No one would try to take off that key, including me. I started to leave.
Wait,
Annie said. She took the key from Fang's collar.
Now I can have my party and you can come.
I, Nate the Great, was glad for Annie and sorry for me. Just then, Rosamond and her four cats came up the walk.
You found the key, she said. I knew I left it in the perfect place.
I, Nate the Great, had many things to say to Rosamond, but the party was starting. Annie unlocked the door. We all went inside. We sat around the birthday table. Annie gave me the seat of honor because I had solved the case. It was next to Fang. I, Nate the Great, hoped it would be a very short party.
The end.
Nate McAvoy, Monster Hunter, by Bruce Hale. A short story from Guys Read, Thriller, a collection of short stories edited by John Sheska. And now, Nate McAvoy, Monster Hunter, by Bruce Hale. When you show up at your best friend's house to walk to school in the morning, the last thing you expect to hear is,
"Jeremy is missing."
Especially if your best friend is named Jeremy. And especially if he texted you the night before, promising to tell you about monsters.
Missing?
I asked Mrs. Hyken as we stood in the doorway.
Like, missing? Missing?
She blew her bangs off her forehead and shifted Jeremy's baby sister on her hip.
What other kind of missing is there, Nate?
But I knew what she meant. I just couldn't believe it.
Have you called the cops? I asked.
Something went crash in the kitchen. It sounded messy.
Jason!
Yelled Mrs. Hyken.
You better not be getting into those cookies.
Distracted, she looked away towards the ruckus. Didn't seem like the best time to mention that the baby had painted some kind of yellowish goo all over the shoulder of Mrs. Hyken's nice work outfit.
What were we?
She said, turning back.
The cops?
I asked again.
Nate, honey, I don't need the cops. I know where he is.
Where? Just then, Jeremy's 3-year-old brother squealed and burst through the kitchen door. He made a break for the stairs. chubby fists full of cookies.
"Jason Francis Hyken, come back here. You're a booty head," he cried.
Mrs. Hyken chased the little cookie snatcher, talking over her shoulder at me.
"My snake in the grass, soon-to-be ex-husband, took Jeremy."
Then she used some words that had gotten me a-paddling when I said 'em in front of my dad.
"Has he called?" I asked.
"I've left messages for both of them, but I'm sure that dirtbag will phone me any time now to gloat. Jason, come down here this instant."
The brat had made it up the steps.
"Booty, booty, booty head."
Something crashed upstairs. It sounded expansive. The baby on Mrs. Hyken's hip began to blubber, adding snot to the other goo on Mrs. Hyken's top.
"Not now, Jessica."
She jiggled her daughter and flashed a tight smile.
"Gotta go. Duty calls."
Mrs. Hyken stomped upstairs. Back outside, I nosed around for Jeremy's bike. Long gone, just like him. Trudging the 5 blocks to school, I felt like I'd eaten lead waffles for breakfast. I knew Jeremy wasn't at his dad's apartment. I knew he hadn't forgotten to tell Mom about a sleepover. Deep in my gut, I knew the monsters had him. Okay, before we go any further, maybe I should say a word or two about my monster obsession, as Dad calls it. I'm not obsessed, a 5-point vocabulary word meaning totally nuts about something, but I am fascinated. The coolest TV show in the world by far is Monster Hunters. Each week, Jeremy and I watch their ace investigators search for cryptids, creatures like Bigfoot, the Mothman, and the Loch Ness Monster all over the planet. We know cryptids like other kids know baseball players, and Jeremy and I have always, always wanted to photograph a real live cryptid. That would be our ticket onto the show, my life's ambition, which is why last night's message from Jeremy had me so pumped, and why his disappearance had me so worried. I dug around in my backpack for my cell phone, a gift from Dad on my 12th birthday the month before. Turning it on, I scrolled to our texts from last night and reread them for the 10th time. J-Man, you won't believe what I saw. Hunter Nate, what? J-Man, clue. Your dreams are about to come true. Hunter Nate, what? J-Man, gotta check something. Show you tomorrow. Hunter Nate, what? J-Man, your favorite thing. Hunter Nate, cryptids? J-Man, oh, maybe. Smiley face. Hunter Nate, tell me. J-Man, later, dude. That told me a whole bunch of nothing useful. What was he going to check on? Where had he found this thing? And what the heck had he found? Jeremy knew my big dream, so his secret had to be connected with cryptids. But how could that be? Seriously, what kind of cryptid would hang out in a blah little suburb like Whippleboro, Massachusetts? The Mall Monster? The Abominable Snowblower Man? The creature from the Stinkity Skating Rink? And what exactly was it doing with my best friend? My thoughts whirled as I shuffled to school in a daze. I wanted to go grab my bike and start looking for Jeremy, but without knowing what he'd found, I had no clue where to start. Besides, as a passing cop car reminded me, grown-ups generally frown on cops ditching school. Wait, a cop car? Hey! I shouted. I waved my hands and ran after it, book bag thumping against my back. Stop! Help! Come back! A half block later, the black and white pulled over to the curb ahead of me. The window buzzed down on the passenger side, and a beefy white guy with a furry caterpillar mustache leaned out. "What's the problem, kid?"
"It's my friend," I panted. "He's missing."
"Oh, yeah?" said Officer Mustache. His eyes hid behind dark sunglasses. The caterpillar on his lip twitched.
"How long?"
"Since,
Now that I thought of it, Mrs. Hyken hadn't told me when Jeremy disappeared.
"Since last night."
Officer Mustache looked over at his partner, a lean black woman with a serious expression and shades to match.
"What do your friend's parents say?" she asked. "His, mom says she thinks Jeremy's dad took him."
"Uh-huh,"
said Officer Sirius.
"But I think something else, someone else got him. Please, can you start looking?"
The cops traded another glance.
"D-I-V-O-R-C-E,
said Officer Sirius, as if I couldn't spell for beans.
"Yup,"
said Officer Mustache. He turned back to me.
"Has his mom filed a report?"
"No."
"Then there's nothing we can do."
I clenched my fists in frustration. "But I just know something's wrong. Please?" Officer Sirius shot me a look.
"Go to school, kid. He'll probably be home back by the time you are."
I pulled out all the stops, giving them the old lost my puppy stare. "Please?" Two pairs of sunglasses stared back, like the eyes of two giant bugs dressed in blue. The window buzzed up, and the car rolled away. Shoot! I shifted my book bag on my shoulders. So the police wouldn't do anything. Fine. I'd rescue Jeremy myself. I'd... Bring! Went the bell. Do it right after school. The morning's classes passed in a blur. All through math and social studies, I kept turning the problem over in my head. How could I figure out where Jeremy had gone? By the time the lunch bell rang, I knew where to start. I wolfed down my county fair dog and potato salad and hit the library. The librarian, Mrs. Kunkel, sat in her office, eating macaroni from a takeout container and staring blankly into space, like she was on screensaver mode. I waved. She waved back, without shifting her eyes or slowing down her fork. Just my luck. One of the computers was free. I opened the web browser and typed Cryptid Whippleboro Mass into the search engine. Bam! 55,681 hits. Great! I took about 10 minutes checking out the websites. Normally, I love this stuff and could spend my whole lunch hour reading it, but not today. I couldn't stop thinking of Jeremy, captured somewhere, with monsters standing over him, drooling. Right away, I skipped all of the ghost-related websites. Serious monster hunters don't believe in ghosts. I zeroed in on true cryptids. The Dover demon looked promising. Huge orange eyes, watermelon head, makes blood-curdling noises. But Dover was at least 3 hours away. I kept searching. Puckwudgies caught my eye next. Goofy name, but these cryptids were anything but goofy. Puckwudgies are gray, troll-like creatures that can appear and disappear at will. They can change themselves into different animals. They've been sighted all over Massachusetts. And, according to Wampanoag tribal legends, they love playing nasty tricks on humans. I scanned page after page, but I couldn't find any helpful details on puckwudgies, like where they hung out, what they did with kidnapped kids, or how you dealt with them once you found them. There had to be someone I could ask. Duh. Of course. if the staff of my favorite TV show didn't know more about Puckwudgies than anyone around, I'd eat my book bag, or the cafeteria's mystery meat, whichever was worse. I got the Monster Hunter's phone number from their website. Stepping outside, I punched the digits into my cell phone. True, Dad had said to use it only for emergencies, but if this wasn't an emergency, what was? After 5 rings, a bored-sounding woman's voice said, "Monster Hunters, no cryptid too cryptic. How can I help you?" Now that the moment had arrived, I choked. This woman could connect me with one of the Monster Hunters. I might even end up talking with Ace Gronstein himself. "What do you want, kid?" I cleared my throat. "Can I, talk to one of the Monster Hunters?"
"Regarding what?"
Puckwudgies. I need anything they can tell me. The woman grunted. Her hand must have covered the phone, because next I heard a brief, muffled conversation. She came back on.
"They're not available right now."
I gripped the phone. "When will they be?"
"I could take a message," she said, sounding like she'd rather jam a sharp pencil into her eyeball.
"This is important," I snapped. "A kid's life is at stake."
A rusty-sounding chuckle leaked from the phone. "Good one. So, someone's gonna kill you if you don't turn in your cryptid report on time."
"No, it's my friend. He..."
"Thanks for watching, kid. See ya."
The line went dead. I sagged against the red brick wall of the library. My mind spun around and around, and like a silver ball in one of those arcade games, it finally went down the last hole left. I gulped. There was only one person who could tell me what I needed to know, and that one person was the toughest kid in 6th grade, Brandon Fry. Normally, Brandon is the last guy you'd go looking for. He's built like a big brown refrigerator with a shock of thick black hair, eyes like black lasers, and the sweet disposition of a hungry wolverine. Even teachers get nervous around him. But Brandon was the only part Wampanoag person I knew. If anyone at school could fill me in on Puckwudgies, it would be him. Finding Brandon wasn't a problem. Lunchtimes, he usually hung out with his girlfriend and some other tough kids on the benches by the baseball diamond. Talking to him was the problem. I stuffed my hands into my jeans pockets and drifted toward the benches, pretending to watch some kids playing pickle out on the field. Brandon and his friends laughed at some joke. Hearing that, I thought, "Good mood," and turned around. "Hi, Brandon," I said. The laughter stopped like someone threw a switch. Brandon Fry, his two weasel-like buddies, and his red-haired girlfriend all stared at me. "Nice day, huh?" I squeaked.
"Nice day for a poundin'," said the first weasel guy. Weasel number two snickered. Brandon kept staring. "I know you," he rumbled. The guy's voice was as low as a high schooler's.
"We were in 4th grade together," I said. "Now we're in Mr. Sarner's science class."
I'm not sure why everything I said came out like a question.
"You're Nick," he said.
"It's, Nate, actually." He shook his massive head.
"Nick."
I shrugged. "Okay, Nick. Listen, can we talk?"
"All Brandon wants to hear from you is, 'Here's my lunch money,'" said Weasel Number One.
I held my palms up.
already spent it. I just want some information.
Brandon cocked his head and narrowed his eyes, considering me. He spat.
What'll you pay?
Pay?
Yeah,
he said.
I answer your questions. I'm giving you something. What'll you give me?
I dug in my pockets. Nothing but lint and odd scraps of paper.
What do you want?
Brandon chuckled.
What do I want? $1,000,000. A new house for my family. To win the ultimate fighting smackdown. And for losers to stop calling me Injun.
The weasel guys laughed and bumped fists. The red-headed girl swatted his arm in that funny way that girls do.
What do I want from you?
Brandon stood towering over me. The sun disappeared behind his head. I gulped.
A game of flinch.
What? Flinch was a dumb game the guys at my school played. Basically, if you made the other person flinch, you got to slug them on the shoulder.
Yeah, said Brandon Fry. For every question, we play one round. Deal?
Deal? I thought for a bit, wanting to get my questions just right. Too few, and I wouldn't find Jeremy. Too many, and I'd lose the use of my arm. Okay, I said. First question. If we had Puckwudgies living in the area, where would I find them? Brandon's forehead crinkled, and he gave a disbelieving smirk.
Puckwudgies? You've been talking to my grandma?
Weasel number one looked confused. What's a Puckawuddy?
Only a nasty little troll that likes to push people off cliffs, said Brandon, making claws of his hands. He fainted at his friends, who chuckled nervously. And you want to find a Puckwudgie? He asked me.
I nodded.
You crazy, Nick.
He gave an elaborate shrug.
But if they exist, they like caves, tunnels, that sort of place. That's what Grandma says.
Quick as a snake striking, Brandon jammed two fingers toward my eyes. I blinked and moved back.
Flinch!
He grabbed my right arm with one meaty fist and pounded my shoulder hard with the other.
Ow! Ow!
After he let go, I rubbed my sore arm. The weasel guys hooted. Next question, I said. Do Puckwudgies have any weaknesses? Brandon walked around me, rubbing his jaw.
Let's see. From what I remember, they like strawberry bread.
Strawberry shortcake?
The red-headed girl asked. He arched a dark eyebrow.
You think the old-time Wampanoag had shortcake and whipped cream? Nah. Strawberry bread, like banana bread, but with strawberries.
Anything else? I asked. Brandon snapped his fingers.
And water. They make some kind of magic fire, so they don't like water.
Magic fire? Ah!
The up-close and personal sight of Brandon's fist whooshing towards my nose, turned my question into a shout.
Flinched again, he sang.
This time, Brandon wound up like a home run slugger. His mighty punch zoomed straight for my poor shoulder, and at the last second, he turned it into a little tap. Uproarious laughter from his sidekicks. Never mind that he'd already mangled me. I held my arm protectively and wondered if Jeremy would come visit me in the hospital. Assuming, of course, that I managed to find him. Brandon smirked and rubbed his knuckles into his palm.
Any other questions, Nick?
Which way to the emergency room?
came to mind, but I didn't say it. No, that's all. Thanks for the, help. He spread his hands.
Anytime.
Come on, guys. The weasel dudes and the redhead ambled off after Brandon. They looked like pilot fish trailing a tiger shark. About 20 feet off, Brandon Fry turned.
Hey, Nick.
Yeah, I called. His dark eyes turned serious.
Watch yourself with those puckwudgies. They make me look like a Girl Scout.
Weasel number two started to snicker until Brandon showed him his fist. That shut him up. A softball rolled across the grass and stopped near my feet.
A little help,
cried one of the guys playing pickle. I cocked my foot and kicked it to him. Ball tossing would have to wait till I got some feeling back into my arm. By the time the last bell rang, I had patched together a plan, sort of. I felt a bit nervous about facing a bunch of evil trolls on my own, so I went for backup. Leaving school, I spotted Kellen Bradley waiting at the curb for his ride. Perfect. He was a sort of friend, the tallest boy in our grade, next to Brandon, and a total jock. Hey, Kellen. He jerked his chin at me.
What's up, Nate?
I'm, going on a little adventure. His eyebrows rose.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Jeremy kind of got himself into a tight spot, so I'm gonna go rescue him. Wanna come? The eyebrows came back down.
Is it dangerous?
I shrugged. A little bit. Maybe.
Gee, I'd really like to, but I've got karate class.
See, that's why I thought you...
And here's my ride.
A blue-gray SUV pulled up to the curb. Kellen opened the passenger door and slipped inside.
Sorry, Nate. See ya.
And the car drove off. On the walk home, I called my dad.
Hey, buddy, what's up?
Are you busy?
He chuckled. Yeah, I'm slammed. We got that big meeting and I won't be home until late, remember?
What's going on?
Shoot. Although Dad was pretty open-minded about my cryptid hobby, I doubted he'd blow off a major meeting to go monster hunting.
Nothing, I guess. Hey, can I take some money from the cookie jar for a snack?
Sure thing, buddy. Just don't max out on the sweets.
I won't. Dad, I...
Yes, Nate?
I shook my head.
Nothing. See you later.
We hung up. I'd almost told him I loved him. That was nuts. This was just gonna be a quick in and out. Find Jeremy, grab Jeremy, run like heck. No big deal. Right? So why was my stomach doing flip-flops? It took about 15 minutes to collect everything I needed and stuff it into my book bag. Then I rode my bike to the supermarket and picked up the last items. Assuming Jeremy had seen Puckwudgies, and assuming that's who had him now, and also assuming Brandon hadn't lied, a lot of assumptions, I was left with two likely places to search. The caves and the storm drains. I really hoped it wasn't the storm drains. They gave me the creeps. Many times, Jeremy had tried to talk me into exploring them, and I'd always found an excuse not to. Until now. But the drains, big concrete tunnels that sluiced rainwater away from the town, were much closer than the caves. So that's where I went first. A cold breeze whipped through my jacket as I pedaled past the last houses and out to the Little League diamonds. The season was over, the grass had turned brown, and that metal thingy on the rope kept striking the empty flagpole with a lonely ting, ting, ting. I was all alone.
A deep gully snaked around the outer edge of the Far Diamond. At its widest bend lay the hungry mouth of the storm drain. Oh, boy. I leaned my bike against an oak tree, hefted my book bag, and stepped over to the edge of the gully. I promised myself that I'd take a look, just a look, before moving on to check out the caves. "He's probably not here," I muttered. Scrambling down the bank, I was thankful that it hadn't rained for a week. Only a trickle of water burbled down the gully, but it was enough to create a wide, muddy spot at the edge of the concrete apron. Tracks crisscrossed the mud, tennis shoes, dog and raccoon prints, and the traces of something my old Cub Scouts training hadn't covered. The tracks looked like those of a barefoot human, only wider, but with claw marks, and only four toes. A shiver danced down my spine. I sighted along the footprints, and they seemed to head straight for the black, gaping mouth of a tunnel, the storm drain. Something orange caught my eye. Then I saw it, up behind the bushes on the opposite bank. Jeremy's bike. Great. He must have hidden it there when he went to investigate. And now it was my turn. I checked my watch. Maybe an hour of daylight left. I wiped my palms on my jeans. Something in my gut told me I really didn't want to be down in the tunnels when night fell. Hands padded pockets for a final check. Flashlight, cell phone, pocket knife, squirt gun. I was as ready as I'd ever be. "Stop stalling," I mumbled, approaching the rusty metal grill that blocked the tunnel mouth. My hands gripped the cold iron bars. "Probably won't open," I thought. "Probably rusted shut." A firm tug, and the grill swung upward with a moan. I flinched so violently Brandon could have slugged me three times. So much for the element of surprise. I flicked on the flashlight, squeezed under the grill, and stepped into a puddle of water. Shoop! Galoshes! I knew I'd forgotten something. The flashlight beam played over a concrete tunnel a little taller than me, walls stained dark with water, and floor covered in rubbish and rocks. After about 20 feet, the glow of my light was swallowed by pitch black. I gulped. On one wall, in red, some joker had spray-painted a skull and crossbones over a message. "Keep out, dummy!" Good advice! I ignored it. Taking a deep breath, I crept forward, one hand on the flashlight, one on the side wall for balance. My every footfall echoed and re-echoed. A faint cabbagey odor mingled with the rich smells of earth and water. Now and then, I got a whiff of some animal's poop, ripe. About 50 feet in, I turned to look back. The entrance had shrunk to a circle of light about the size of my fist. My heart thudded unevenly. "Just a nice little underground stroll," I told myself. "Nothing to get spooked about." Right. I pushed on. Not far ahead, more of the creepy-looking tracks crossed a patch of mud. A faint light spilled from above. Craning my neck, I saw a shaft with a grill at the top. I figured I was under a street. Splashing echoed in the tunnel ahead. I pointed the flashlight. Red eyes glowed in the dark. Ah! I jumped. And then I relaxed. Trapped in my beam was a fat raccoon. It grumbled at me. But when I chucked a rock in its direction, the animal hissed and retreated down a side tunnel. When I reached the passage, I shined the light down it.
The raccoon was nowhere to be seen. Weird. I continued down the main tunnel. A minute later, the smooth concrete pipe ended. From here, the passage was made of individual stone blocks fitted together like a wall. It looked really old, like pilgrims old. Pukwudgie territory. I moved slower, trying to keep quiet. The tunnel curved, then widened into a section where big stone pillars held up the roof. Lots of the strange footprints crisscrossed the muddy floor. Another side tunnel led off to the right, glowing faintly from deep inside. I heard a distant chuckling, like an underground stream or far-off voices. It was hard to tell which. The flashlight beam revealed a regular Pukwudgie freeway of footprints headed this way. I shrugged the book bag off my shoulders and took out the white bread and strawberries. Then I crept to the far end of the chamber, opened the packages, and started making strawberry sandwiches, smooshing the fruit to release its smell. I laid the sandwiches on some sheets of notebook paper. Come and get it! Then I tiptoed back and stepped behind a pillar close by the entrance to the side passage. Off went the flashlight. I crouched against the column to wait. Time passed. I didn't know how much. I thought about how dumb I'd feel if the raccoon returned and ate the sandwiches. I thought about how scared I'd feel if I was still down here at night. The darkness crowded in. The weight of all that earth above me seemed to press down like a giant hand. I could picture the ceiling collapsing and burying me under the rocks, so archaeologists from some future time would find my bleached bones. This is why I'm not so crazy about tunnels. My fingernails dug into my palms. I opened my eyes wide, but all I could see was more darkness. Then a faint light. Were my eyes playing tricks? Slowly, steadily, it strengthened, bringing the far wall into focus, as if the glow came from the side tunnel. Stealthy little shuffling accompanied the light. I held my breath. Something passed by on the other side of the pillar. Ever so sneakily, I peeked around the corner. A possum? The raspy-looking gray-furred beast waddled along, sniffing the air. It caught the scent of the strawberries and perked right up. Then it scampered toward the far side of the chamber, much faster than a possum could move. When it reached the feast, it raised a weird cry. That cry was echoed in the side tunnel, and suddenly a dozen or more creatures hurried past, following the possum. The hair on my neck stood up. Light from the torches they carried revealed gray-skinned, muscular, pot-bellied creatures. Their hair hung long and matted, their noses and ears were grotesquely huge, and their long fingers reminded me of spider legs. The creatures stank of wet dog and cabbage. They looked like something from a particularly nasty fairy tale. Pukwudgies. The creatures stood maybe a foot shorter than me, but I wouldn't want to face one in a dark tunnel, let alone a dozen. The last of the bunch descended on the strawberry feast, jabbering and arguing in their strange tongue. The possum turned into another Pukwudgie. Cool! My very first cryptids. I reached for my cell phone to photograph them, and then I remembered where I was. Time to move. Heart hammering like crazy, I tiptoed around the pillar and into the side passage. The torch's glow petered out after about 10 feet, so I cautiously switched on my flashlight, shielding the beam with my fingers. The floor was clear of rubble, so I hustled along as quietly as I could, up the tunnel,
around a bend, and suddenly there I was. A high-ceiling cavern opened up before me. Glittering stalactites hung from above. Torches lit a comfortable crash pad for the trolls. Stolen blankets lined sleeping nooks. Pilfered plates rested on a flat rock by a fire pit. And on the other side of the pit, a sad figure slumped, tied with ropes to a stone pillar.
"Jeremy,"
I hissed. His head snapped up. "Nate?" Jeremy's glasses were askew. His curly hair was full of dirt and twigs, and his clothes were a muddy mess, but he was alive.
"Nate, you,
shh," I dashed to his side.
"They'll hear you,"
I whispered. I opened the pocket knife and began sawing at his ropes.
"How did you find me?"
I sat back on my heels. "Through some genius investigative work, actually. See, I figured you were after a cryptid, so I went on the web and searched for..."
"More cutting, less talking."
Jeremy shot a worried glance at the tunnel mouth. "Right." Before long, I had sawed through the last rope. I helped Jeremy to stand. Together, we made our way across the chamber to the exit tunnel and started down the passage.
"Seriously, dude,"
Jeremy whispered.
"How'd you find me?"
"You texted me about cryptids." "No, I didn't." With my free hand, I fished my cell phone from my pocket and handed it to him.
"Look at our messages."
He punched several buttons.
"Where's the..."
"Here, let me." As we kept walking, I called up the menu and opened the saved texts. Jeremy scrolled through them. I never actually said I'd found a cryptid, and especially not... We stepped out of the side tunnel and nearly bumped into a pack of...
"Pukwudgies!"
we screamed.
"Gah!"
the savage trolls screamed back. In that frozen moment, every detail stood out like on high-def TV. The beady black eyes of the creatures, their honking big noses, their bat-like ears, the smears of red fruit on their faces and beards, the sharp claws on their long, grasping fingers. I had time to think. "We are so dead." Click! Went the camera flash on my cell phone. Then, poof, they disappeared. Jeremy and I exchanged a brief, confused look.
"Yeah!"
we cried, rushing forward in a blind panic. I thudded into two or three invisible bodies. Hands snatched at me, but I blew through them. With Jeremy right behind, I barreled up that dim tunnel as fast as I could go. Around the bend, back into the smooth concrete pipe, we ran. Angry hisses and unearthly growls filled the dark behind us, echoing off the walls. Many footsteps pounded.
"Faster!"
Jeremy shouted. We dashed past the raccoon side tunnel, past the shaft leading up to the street. I stumbled over a rock and pitched forward. Only Jeremy's swift grab kept me from doing a faceplant.
"Hurry!" he cried. "They're catching up!"
"This is hurrying!" The tunnel entrance appeared ahead, a faint, small suckle. I ran like I'd never run before. My breath came in ragged gasps. My side ached like someone had stabbed me with a hot knife. With agonizing slowness, the entrance grew bigger. The Pukwudgies' footfalls were deafening. It sounded like an army was running right behind us.
No way!
Could we beat them to the tunnel mouth? And then, 20 feet from the entrance, the sound of pursuit stopped dead. All I could hear was Jeremy's and my footsteps.
"Do you think they gave up?"
I panted.
"Dunno."
We slowed enough for me to shine the flashlight behind us. The dark exploded with chittering. Winged bodies rushed straight at us.
"Bats! Vampire bats!"
cried Jeremy.
Electrified by fear, we bolted for the entrance, jamming through the tunnel side by side.
"Me first," grunted Jeremy. "No, me!"
Together, we hit the iron grill like the front four of the Green Bay Packers.
Bam!
It swung upward. Bat swept past our shoulders, through our hair.
"Ugh!" Jeremy yelled.
The flying rodents spilled through the gaps in the grill and out into the cool twilight air. We staggered forward onto the concrete apron. My shoe caught on a rock, and this time I did go down, plunk, face first into the mud. I rolled over, arms raised to protect myself from the killer bat attack. But no attack came. The bats fluttered past us and dispersed into the gathering night. "Were those Pukwudgies?" said Jeremy, helping me up. "Or real bats?" I looked at the tunnel, then at the bats.
"Either way, let's beat it."
We grabbed our bikes and pumped like crazy for home, setting a new speed record in the process. In fact, we didn't slow down until we turned off Brainerd Street onto my block. Full dark had fallen on the neighborhood, but high above, the sky was still the blue of your oldest pair of jeans. The happy clatter of families making dinner drifted from nearby houses. We stopped at the foot of my driveway.
"Well," said Jeremy, "that happened."
"Yeah, but who'd believe us?" A grin tugged at the corners of his mouth.
"Only the whole world, dude."
"What?" Jeremy pulled my cell phone from his jacket, and I remembered the accidental flash that had startled the Pukwudgies.
"Let me see."
My hands were trembling. The world of cryptid hunters is full of terrible, blurry photos that don't prove anything other than that the person who took them was a lousy photographer. Would our shot be any different? I scrolled through my photo library to the last one taken, and there it was, blurry and dim, but you could just make out the startled faces of two Pukwudgies, honking big noses, beady eyes, and all. "Sweet," said Jeremy. I smiled, but then I looked closer. Behind the trolls, caught in the flash's glare, I saw something I'd never expected. Not in a million years.
"Uh-oh,"
I said. "Is that?" said Jeremy. And I knew our monster adventure was only beginning. That's our show for today. Thank you for listening. This Children's Hour program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I hope you will join us next week for Children's Hour. If you have any comments or ideas, we'd love to hear from you. I'm A. Michelle. Thank you for listening.
Did you know ADA paratransit riders in Worcester, Auburn, Boylston, Leicester, Northboro, Oxford, Westboro, and West Boylston now have the option to schedule trips through the Worcester Regional Transit Authority's new online reservation system? Call customer service at 508-791-9782 or email paratransit at theRTA.com to begin scheduling your trip online.